course development for a summer-like day in Salem. So, let's start by opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2490. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2490, and you should have the A engrossed version, was sponsored by Representative Esquivel, and it allows escrow agents to disperse earnest money based on an agreement of the buyer and seller of real estate transaction that's executed after the initial sales agreement. And the other provision of the bill prohibits escrow agents from imposing any additional requirements on the buyers or sellers, including any requirement that the principal sign a liability release in favor of the agent. There's no fiscal or revenue impact, and Representative Esquivel is here.
I see that. So, Representative, please come forward and tell us all the good things about HB 2490.
For the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. Mr. Chair, Senators, this came, actually I'm going to start from the beginning because I just assume everyone understands my profession, which they do not. And let's take, we all purchase a house usually once in our life. So we are the buyer at one time, and sometimes we are the seller. You enter into a contractual agreement called an earnest money. In the body of the earnest money, there is something we call the earnest money itself, and that's a amount. Usually $1,000 per $100,000 is pretty much rule of thumb. So if you're purchasing a $400,000 house, it's a $4,000 earnest money. Well, what has happened here in the past is about 6 or 8 years ago, you being the buyer and the seller are the two principals. And this goes into what they call escrow, what's a neutral third party, which is only supposed to follow the instructions of both the principals. That's real important. Only to follow the instructions of both principals, which would be the buyer and the seller. Unfortunately, we've had an interpretation by some of the attorneys, by the title companies, where if you terminate this agreement, let's say I decide as the buyer, I don't want to buy your house, and we both agree upon that, and there's something there that I don't like, and so you and myself and you as the two principals terminate the transaction and specifically say in the termination agreement that we terminate it and therefore instruct escrow to disperse the earnest money either back to the buyer or the seller or whatever. But we instruct that individual to take that money someplace and disperse it. The attorneys in the title companies had interpreted in the past, all of a sudden, that they needed an additional release. And you'll see, I believe, were they passed out yet?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You can see these releases. It's basically the same thing of what you have completed in the termination agreement through the real estate contract. But you notice there's some additional language here. And what it is, they have determined that you need to sign this and release them of any liability, which a contract has nothing to do with their liability. That's their business, their insurance people. But they've interpreted another section of disbursement of the escrow officer from the lender and applied it into the contract, which is wrong. Why would that make a difference, you're asking? What's the big deal? What's wrong with a holdup of 4 or 5 days, maybe? I'm going to give you a fine example, and this happened in my office. By the way, I'm a broker owner. We have about 8 agents in our office. And the buyer wasn't forthright. The buyer had been authorized for a loan and pre-approved, and we're getting down towards the end, and the buyer asked the seller through an addendum that they could occupy the property before close of escrow, providing that they disperse the earnest money to the seller. Both parties agreed. We went forward. Escrow did not disperse. Well, during this time that the buyer was there, and by the way, the buyer was painting the inside of the house, unauthorized again, but had possession during that time, and the $3,000 earnest money was still in escrow because we were waiting on this form. The lender found out the buyer had a $16,000 IRS lien, which made the buyer ineligible for the loan. It worked out, and when the buyer found out about this, it worked out that the buyer said, I'm not signing the $3,000 release, even though they've done it by contract. So escrow has in turn caused a problem with the principals, contrary to escrow law. That's why we have to correct this. When they get instructions, and they're a neutral third party, and they should be just like a computer, when the buyer and the seller tell them to do something, they need to do it, providing that it's not against the law. They fabricated this in an interpretation by the attorneys to say that they needed to do this, which is not true. I researched it out. By the way, the head attorney for First American was testifying with me on this, and they're in full agreement. OLTA, Oregon Land and Title Association, as well as the Escrow Council, are in favor of this, as well as the realtors. So if you have any questions, did I confuse you enough, Mr. Chair?
You did just fine, Representative Esquivel. Questions for Representative Esquivel? Okay. Thank you. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2490? Okay. Let's close the public hearing. Open work session. House Bill 2490. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2490 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? No. Any objection? It's ordered. So, should we start right to left today? Senator Starr, would you carry that? Yes, show Deckard is excused until he shows up. Then we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2053. Janet.
Chair and members, House Bill 2053 was pre-session filed by the Public Utility Commission, and it changes the base on which fees are imposed on investor-owned electric utilities from a fee based on kilowatt hours to a fee based on utility gross operating revenues, and it puts a cap of 0.025% of the utility's gross operating revenues. This was the way that the assessments were made prior to 1999, and evidently is consistent with other regulated industries that pay fees to the commission. There is a fiscal impact statement that shows additional revenue to the agency, and there are representatives from the agency to testify.
Okay, let's ask Commissioner Beyer. Is he here? Yes, he is. And Brian Bowe is set up to testify, so why don't you both come forward. The regulated and the regulator.
In full agreement.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and we're here today to ask your approval of House Bill 2053. As Janet said, the bill addresses the methodology for calculating the basic utility fee paid to the commission by investor-owned electrical utilities. In this case, it applies to Portland General, Pacific Core, and Idaho Power. This bill passed the House on a 56-1 vote and is supported by all three of the electrical utilities as well as the consumer groups. What the bill does is return the calculation of the PUC fee on these utilities back to the methodologies that has been used for regulated utilities for the past 80 years, that is, except for electrical, which was changed in 1999. In 1997, the environment was a little different. The PUC proposed and the legislature changed the fee calculation method to respond what was perceived at that time to be a big change in how people would buy their electricity. Basically, what we were looking at that time is a national movement, and Oregon wasn't an exception, to move to wholesale or to retail direct access for customers, wherein they would buy their power from a range of providers. under that scenario, the gross receipts fee that had been used, as I said, for 80 years wouldn't have worked, and so we changed it. Unfortunately, the environment we were expecting didn't occur, and so we're now facing a situation where that fee is essentially flat and, in fact, declining a little bit and doesn't support the inflationary increases that have happened with personnel and healthcare costs and all the things you're familiar with. So in consultation with the utilities and with the consumer groups, what we've come forward with is this bill, HB 2053, and essentially, again, as it does, is it just returns it back to the way it was calculated before the change in 1999, and in fact, the way that we calculated it on all the rest of the utilities that we regulate. The limitation that's there is that no more than 0.25% of gross revenues, the fee would not consist of more than 0.25%, and that works out to about 10% a month on our customer's bill. And there's also a cap on wholesale sales of no more than 1%, 0.25% of the utility's revenues from retail customers. So it's a pretty limiting cap on that. Again, this will stabilize the commission's funding, and it does not provide for any increase in expenditures or FTE, any growth in that way. And again, just to end it, as I said, this is supported by the industry and by the consumer groups who I would say, you might say, why would they support it? And they're interested in making sure that the PUC is stable and is there to watch out and handle the rate obligations and quality of services that's there. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we'll hear from Mr. Bowe first, and then we'll see.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Brian Bowe, representing PacifiCorp. I simply want to confirm what Commissioner Beyer expressed in our support for the concept. We had some initial concerns. We worked with the commission, and those have been addressed, and we believe the bill is good policy and should move forward.
Okay. Thank you. Some questions from the committee. Senator George.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I guess my biggest fear is this is pretty big changes that we did in 97 and 99 and going into the future. And Commissioner Beyer was very good about coming to my office and kind of going through this with me, and I'm just having some reluctancy because I'm not as familiar with this area as I wish I was. If we go into a market in the future and we don't know how this market's going to change, could this somehow impede us to go into more of a free market system if it starts to swing back and there's providers that want to produce electricity? We changed it for a reason at that time, and I understand the market didn't develop the way I think we perceived it would, and it could still in the future. What would be the position of the industry at that point?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it from the folks from our company that worked on it, they don't see that this is as serving as a major impediment in that regard, and that they believe it. Their main concern is, again, as Commissioner Beyer expressed, is that it creates stable funding with the appropriate limitations in place. But I'm not aware of any outstanding or lingering concerns about it being an impediment to a market.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 2053? Okay. Let's close public hearing for a work session on House Bill 2053. Senator Starr. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2053 to the floor to do fast recommendation. Is there further discussion? Senator George.
I'm going to go ahead and vote no here in committee with the likelihood that I'll probably vote yes on the floor. I just want to do some additional research. As I said, Commissioner Beyer was great about coming to my office and explaining the bill to me. And I committed to him that I'd do some additional research, but I'm just a little uncomfortable with sort of changing what happened back at that time. So I'll be voting no, but probably with the likelihood of voting yes on the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Is there further discussion? Any other objections to that, Senator George? Okay, so ordered. And Mark, Senator Deckard is excused, and it's my turn, so I'll carry this one. We'll open up public hearing on House Bill 3360. Janet, your favorite tankless water heater. It's a tankless job you have today.
Uh-huh. Indeed, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 3360, and it's the original version of the bill, is at the request of the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors, and would exempt tankless water heaters from the boiler and pressure vessel laws. And we've had a lot of experience with boiler and pressure vessel laws, so you're in good hands. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. House Bill 3360 simply allows a plumber to install and repair tankless water heaters. Currently, the tankless water heaters are governed under the boiler. You need a boiler license in order to install or repair them. And the reason they're considered a boiler or a pressure vessel is because they, in many cases, surpass the 200,000 BTU per hour heat input standard. As you probably know, tankless water heaters don't resemble boilers at all. They're, and often, in most cases, are about suitcase size. They don't store water, and instead water is piped directly through them, which triggers the heating element and thus the constant supply of hot water. And as you recall, with Senate Bill 193, even DCBS implicitly acknowledges that the tankless heaters are not the same as boilers or pressure vessels, as the department's bill exempts these particular heaters from a state boiler examination. So we request your support for House Bill 3360.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, we have done a little boiler stuff here lately. Any questions for Mr. Wilson? Mr. Wong did not sign up. Do you have any desire to testify? Okay. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3360 and open a work session.
Chair, I move House Bill 3360 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3360 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. I mark Senator Deckard as excused. And Senator Monis Anderson?
All righty.
This is the tankless water heater bill for you.
I'll be able to do that again.
Okay. Next victim. Open up public hearing on House Bill 2219. Janet.
So Chair and members, House Bill 2219, and you should have the A engrossed version, was pre-session filed at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which is also within DCBS. The bill makes a number of changes to a bill that passed last session to streamline the license application process for various trade licenses that are administered by the Building Codes Division. And those changes are throughout the bill are fairly non-substantive. They make things consistent between the several licensing programs. There's a deletion of a fee on page 7, line 35, for the $10 fee that for taking a qualifying examination. So, again, elimination of a fee because the other licensing boards do not have the same fee. And the agency is ready to walk through the bill.
Okay. Mr. Long.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Long. I'm the Administrator of State Building Codes Division. This is a regulatory streamlining bill. As staff indicated, it expands on the work that we did last session to make the processes between four of the boards that I have that issue licenses. We're talking about electricians, plumbers, folks that work on boilers, and then some manufactured housing, to make the processes between those boards operate more smoothly and use the same terms. This does not change the requirements of what it takes to get a license, what we call to obtain the license. It only changes the requirements to maintain the license or keep it, how you, the administrative provisions for how you apply, how you renew your continuing education, those kinds of areas. When we went to implement House Bill 2181 from the 05 session, we identified a couple other areas amongst these licensing boards that just wasn't consistent between themselves. Specific areas in the plumbing program, they require a practical examination as well as a written examination. The other boards did not, so the plumbers were gracious enough to eliminate the practical exam requirements. We made that consistent so that the procedures are the same. For boilers in the continuing education area, they were different than the plumbers, electricians, and the other areas. So we worked with the boiler community and eliminated the statutory specifics for continuing education, and we'll put that with the board. There are no changes in fees other than a reduction of $13,000 to my department for an exam fee in the electrical area because plumbers and boilers, manufactured housing, didn't have an exam fee. So we're going to leave some money on the table in order to be consistent, but I think it's the right thing to do. It also clarifies that we can create a 3-year or multiple-year licenses. Most of my industries suggest that we go to a 3-year license, and so it clarifies that the renewal and application areas are per year, so then we could times it times 3 if we offer a 3-year license, and we would just use the fee that's set in statute and times it by the number of years the license is good for. Moved out of committee on a 6 aye votes, 1 excused, and through the House floor 54-6. Other than that, I'll be happy to take your questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Long. Questions for Mr. Long? Yes, Senator Starr.
So you're leaving $13,000 on the table, but shouldn't this bill actually save the department money? Because if you go to a 3-year license, it's less paperwork for your department in order to... ultimately, it should save money, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, it should save our office some money, but it also should save the customers money by not having to apply multiple times and carry one card.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Anybody else feel compelled to testify today on 2219? Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2219 and open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2219 to the Senate floor with a due pass
recommendation. Okay, Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2219 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Other discussion? Objection? So ordered. Mark Senator Deckard has excused. This is the fee reduction bill, and we happen to be at the left side of the dais today. Would you like to carry that one?
Good, yeah, sure.
All right, see?
Anytime.
Say karma.
We can do more of those.
Karma, it's working here. Okay, Senator George will carry.
I hope he doesn't find a fee in there.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's open up a public hearing on House Bill 3353. Janet.
Oh, my goodness.
A little landscaping now. Or pests.
Chair members, House Bill 3353, the A engrossed version, at the request of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. And they worked with the agency and with the Department of Agriculture on this bill, and it eliminates a pesticide applicator licensing exemption that they currently have for persons that are engaged in the maintenance of lawn, shrubs, or gardens. And it allows the fee for pesticide training certificate to be less than the fee for the pesticide applicator license, so they would be getting a trainee certificate. Mr. Chair, the changes are in line 17 and 18 on the first page of the bill, that language being taken out. So this is a pesticide applicator chapter, and it says that these requirements do not apply to, and they're taken out as an exemption. And that's also in the top of page 3, that language at the top of page 3.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Stone, Mr. Cross. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. My name is Bill Cross, and I really just wanted to introduce you to John Stone, the president of that association. He'll quickly walk you through the bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Stone.
Thank you. Chair Metzger, board, my name is John Stone. I own J.P. Stone Contractors, a landscape company working in the Portland area, and I request your support on HB 3353, and it addresses several pesticide-related licensure issues of concern to the landscape contractors. Basically, we presently enjoy an exemption from from the pesticide licensure requirement if we don't quote-unquote make a business out of applying pesticides. If we don't tell our customers that we're going to or sell our customers the pesticide application service, like for instance spraying weeds or something like that, we don't and we don't charge them for it, we can apply that those materials. A lot of pesticides are applied this way. Larger companies have a pesticide license through the Department of Agriculture, and they sell that service, and they have to adhere to CEUs, fairly heavily required CEUs to maintain that license. Under that license, they can employ trainees who get a trainee license, fairly easy to get. People have to learn the basic safety and requirements of the pesticide involved, and they have to work at the direction of the license holder. What we would like to do is give up the exemption that we currently have, so that anyone applying pesticides under that exemption would either have to get the main license or they would have to subcontract that work to somebody who does have a license. And then we would like it to make it a little bit easier for the trainees to get that trainee license and maintain that license on an ongoing basis, where they would work at the direction of somebody who holds the central license.
Okay. Senator Moss Harris.
What about, I guess maybe I need to know what a pesticide applicator is. I'm thinking, what if I wanted to put weed and feed on my rental property that I use on my own land? Is that considered a... Well, that's...
Weed and feed is a pesticide for us. You, as an owner, don't have any regulatory requirements that I'm aware of with regards to it. But we have to, if I were going to do it for you at your rental, I would have to do it just in the matter of course of doing business and not point out to you that that's what we're doing, and I can't charge you specifically for that work.
But me as a renter, or as a landlord, could do that on my own. Usually
you can do it on
contract
your own
out just
as a homeowner.
You know.
I'm not sure about, I don't know, and I think some of the gentlemen who are going to testify after me may know that better.
Okay.
It doesn't apply to me, what you're talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Senator George.
So if you have somebody, some kid in the neighborhood who's mowing lawns for take, and you say, hey, can you put some Roundup out there on that bark dust out there, he's got to have a pesticide applicator's license now under this bill?
Technically.
Wow.
And presently he doesn't.
Right.
And that material is being applied presently in a fairly uncontrolled fashion. There's requirements to keep track of how much you use and where you use it. It's not fully implemented yet that we understand how much Roundup is being applied.
Mr. Chair, follow-up? I guess the question is, why does this need to be? What problem are we trying to solve with this particular piece of legislation?
Two problems. One is that a lot of pesticides are being applied in an uncontrolled fashion by people who are not necessarily qualified to do it. And then the other is to make it a little bit easier and more applicable for the trainees to be able to utilize their license. The difference between yourself and me doing it is that you as a homeowner are essentially only applying it to one property. And if you make a mistake, it's only done once. If I'm doing it, I might be doing it 100 or 200 or 1,000 times a year in an incorrect fashion.
Mm-hmm.
If it's required that I have a license, then presumably I'll understand the technical requirements of applying the various pesticides and run less danger of environmental degradation as a result of it.
Mr. Chairman, I kind of want one last follow-up on that. It seems like to me, and we're getting to this area where you could have a kid who does some stuff in a neighborhood making a little extra money or whatever, and I'm just thinking of a scenario, but would you be open to an exemption that said, you know, if you didn't do more than 10 houses per year,
well,
operator?
The kid is not licensed
right.
under the LCB, first of all.
Right.
And maintenance is not required to be licensed
right.
under the LCB or any other agency at present. So I don't know exactly where that circumstance would fall,
okay.
but it really wouldn't fall in our house at this point.
Yeah, but this bill does.
What's that?
Mr. Chair. Yeah, but this bill does. This bill definitely regulates the individual that Senator George is referencing, even though he's not doesn't have to have a low landscape contractor's license. So I think that...
Chan, do you have a color?
No. Well, I'm just questioning the same thing you are, Mr. Chair. And Senator
Starter,
current exemption is for persons who do not advertise or publicly hold themselves out as being in the business of applying pesticides, but whose main or principal work or business is the maintenance of smaller home lawn shrubs or gardens. So I guess you could apply that to us.
My understanding is it's the landscape, it's people who own the landscape, who have a landscape contractor's license who have that exemption.
Mr. Chair.
Uh-huh.
It seems to me that this bill is a bill that's brought to us by the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association to regulate people that aren't regulated at this point. I wonder what the Oregon Lawn and Maintenance Care Association members would think about this bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, you'll hear from the other applicators. I think this goes beyond landscape contractors, obviously. And we were trying to get at the businesses, not the teenager out there that's doing some summer work, but at businesses who are holding themselves out doing maintenance work, who included in that are doing pesticide applications in homes. And there are situations where those are a public safety issue, where they have no training, they're spraying, there's wind, and it is a hazard. So our attempt, and when we worked with the Department of Agriculture and Oregonians for Food and Shelter, was to try and get at that loophole and eliminate it, so that indeed all businesses that are applying pesticides would have to conform with some licensure and educational requirements.
Okay, I tell you what, let's ask Mr. Kirby and Mr. Witt to come forward. Why don't you guys just step back for a moment. Let's hear from them, and that may answer some questions, may bring new questions up, but let's... Welcome. Who would like to start?
For the record, my name is Chris Kirby. I'm an employee of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I serve as the administrator of the Pesticides Division. My division is involved in administering the Oregon Pesticide Control Act, Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 634. House Bill 3353, A. Engrossed, proposes to amend certain sections of that statute. We have been in communication with the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, and the agency does support the engrossed version of this bill. As we see it, this does two things. One is to remove a present exemption that exists in the statutes for certain individuals that do apply pesticides upon the property of another, and therefore do meet the definition in statute of a pesticide operator. However, unlike the requirements for other pesticide operators, these folks do not have to be examined, do not have to carry insurance, do not have to be licensed. This removal of exemption, we think, would put all those companies that apply pesticides on the property of others on the same playing field, require the same requirements and education of their users. The second part of the A. Engrossed bill allows the department to charge a lesser fee for commercial and public trainees than is charged for commercial and public applicators. The current language mandates that the license fees be the same. And as I said before, the department does support the engrossed version of this bill, and I'd be willing to address any questions that the committee has.
Well, Mr. Kirby, I think, first of all, can you address any of the questions raised by Senator George or Senator Starr in terms of the scope of applicability to the bill?
Mr. Chair, I believe Senator George's question had to do specifically with, say, a high school student who during the summer would be mowing lawns and might be requested by a homeowner to apply some pesticides in the yard. My understanding is that the engrossed version, if it were adopted, would pertain to that individual. That individual would need to be licensed by the department to apply the same sorts of pesticides that other companies, large commercial companies, would be using. We think that the removal of the exemption would actually be a benefit to the public from the standpoint of safety, a benefit to the environment from the standpoint of safety, and to the individual users, because it would require them to be educated in what they're doing.
Okay. Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I'm here today representing not only Oregonians for Food and Shelter, but the Oregon Pest Control Association and the Interstate Pesticide Applicators Association, which the OPCA basically deals with structural pest control, and IPAA deals with lawn and garden types of application. We support House Bill 3353. We think it's a step in the right direction. Anytime there is significant pesticides being applied in the environment, we would prefer to have that being done by licensed applicators who are trained. And I've had some personal experience with landscape contractors in my own yard applying pesticides that had no clue whatsoever as to what they were applying. And I think this is a good step in the right direction. I think with regard to the questions by Senator George and Senator Starr, there may be a very small handful of people that get captured under this requirement, but I think that's a very small price to pay for the benefits that we would receive. Okay. Glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Okay, questions for these two individuals.
Yes.
Senator Moss.
I think this might have a huge impact on a number of landlords who maintain, you know, say have one or two rentals and use things like Roundup. And I don't know if they use it indiscriminately. I know I use Roundup on my rental along the fence line. That's the only place I use it, and I don't know if that's bad or good, so maybe I need the training. But I certainly, unless I was a legislator, would know whether I was supposed to be licensed or not. Now, in a case like that where I only use it to along a fence line, I would need to be licensed under this. Is that correct?
Well, can I interject there? I don't think so, Senator Montes Anderson. This exemption is not for an individual applying it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and as I heard the testimony and read, it's for people who advertise that you are a business of applying pesticides. There's the exemption is not for people using it on their property, but who do not advertise or publicly hold themselves out as being in the business of applying pesticides. So if you're a landlord of an apartment complex, you're not in the pesticide applying business. You're not advertising that you go out and do other people's apartments. I mean, am I reading that incorrectly? Because that's how I read that.
Oh, I thought that.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with your interpretation. The statutes define commercial operators as individuals who apply pesticides on the property of another. So when you are making applications to your own property, whether it's a rental property or not, you are not a commercial pesticide operator.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Yes, and I forget your name, Mr. Kirby. I think you're absolutely wrong. That's not what this says. Unless you don't define person somewhere that says persons is not commercial applicator. It says persons who do not advertise or publicly hold themselves out to be in the business of applying pesticides. So that's a person who's not a licensed applicator today. That's a person that's any person who isn't a licensed applicator who advertises as he's a pesticide guy or gal, but whose main principal work or business is the maintenance of small home lawns, shrubs, or gardens.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I believe the definition of pesticide applicator in statute says that it's applying it to the property of others, I believe. Chris has got the statute.
But that's not what this statute doesn't refer to.
Pardon?
This statute doesn't refer to that. This is the exemption statute to that law.
But it's all under, I would believe it's all under 634, which is the pesticide statutes, which define pesticide applicator for all purposes within that statute.
634, 106.
Yeah. 106 is the definition sections.
Mr. Chair, were you looking up? Can I ask one quick question?
Yeah, Senator.
Here's the scenario, I guess, guys, that I'm dealing with, and it's just my own head. I had two rentals at a time. I had a woman who was just sort of managing those for me, and she would charge me an hourly rate to do so. And so she basically took care of finding my renters for me and handling it for me. It was sort of like an in-house rental agency, but she just worked for me. And she was a master gardener. So as part of her work on an hourly basis, she would make sure he'd cut the lawns, and sometimes she'd bring somebody else, and I'd pay them to cut the lawns, and then she'd spray out the weeds and all that kind of stuff. And it seems like to me, under that kind of scenario, or if I had an apartment complex and the person who was living there maintaining it decided to do the yard work themselves, they would have to get an applicator's license under this scenario. under both those scenarios, the person doing that for me, even if, let's say, for instance, you're correct in the interpretation, under the scenario I gave out, they would have to get an applicator's license also for small. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think it depends upon the employment situation, and if an individual were your employee working on your property at your direction, then I would not foresee that they would be subject to licensing requirements. However, if you hired a business to come in and do it, then yes, they would be subject to the requirements.
I can't read it right. It's not plain English. Didn't we pass a bill that would put this in plain English?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, plain language. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator.
If based on the reasoning rationale that's been presented here, I don't know why we would exempt persons that sell pesticides or the railroads. The railroads are exempt. Why would we exempt them? We exempt a lot of folks and for having to have a pesticide applicator's license.
Anybody want to respond?
Mr. Chair, there are different provisions of 634 as far as operator licensing requirements. Public entities are not required to be licensed as public as commercial operators. In fact, they're prohibited from being licensed as commercial operators. Dealers, when they are only selling pesticides, are not required to be licensed as commercial operators. However, some companies do have, besides sales facilities, application facilities, and then they are subject to licensing as operators.
But the railroads can, Mr. Chair, the railroads can apply pesticides along their rail line without having to have a pesticide applicator's license.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, their employees come under licensing as public applicators. So their employees who make the applications are required to be licensed, are required to be educated, are required to be recertified. The railroad company itself, spraying its own right-of-way, does not currently have to be licensed as an operator, but its employees doing the work do have to be licensed.
I think where we are right now, I think the committee, I think we need Janet to work with council. We need to find out, I think the key thing is the answer to the question of who does it apply to, who does it not. I think that's, most of our questions are about that, and then we'll make a policy decision whether that's a good thing or bad. But I think we need to have that clarity to make sure who's under the umbrella and who isn't. And I don't think we can do that at the moment. But Janet, let's see if we can find out who we capture here, and then we'll bring back and we'll have a discussion as to whether that's what we want to do. How's that? So let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3353, and we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 3354, and that's John and Bill again. Welcome. I have a funny feeling he's just going to introduce again, Mr. Stone, so we'll let you start.
Okay. My name is still John Stone, and I still know JP Stone Contractors. Currently, there is an exemption for limited energy electrical activity involving the installation of landscape irrigation control wiring and outdoor landscape lighting by licensed landscape contractors. However, over the past years, the industry technology has changed, and many of the irrigation controllers and valves are 24-volt, and many of the low-voltage lighting transformers have multiple outputs ranging from 12 to 22 volts. The National Electrical Code has recognized these changes, but because these products exceed what is allowed by the state's current exemption, OLCA, Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, requests your support in modifying the statutory restrictions. We've worked with the Building Codes Division and the National Electrical Contractors Association on the development of HB 3354 to ensure that the changes to the current exemption allow a level of electrical activity that is commensurate with the common products and design demands of the landscape industry, balanced with safety considerations. The -1 amendment to the bill addresses the appropriate parameters parameters and is limited to low voltage installation by licensed landscape contractors. Passage of HB 3354 will help enhance the ability of the landscape contractors to provide common low voltage installations to their customers with appropriate safety limitations that have served as the basis of the state's electrical laws. We urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have anything you want to add, Mr. Cross?
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. Mr. Paul Phillips was here. He did have to just leave for an appointment. However, as our testimony alludes, NECA is fine with the bill as long as there are no additional amendments.
Okay. So we're getting our low voltage thing covered here a little bit. Is there any questions from the committee on that at all? Any concerns by the committee? Anybody else want to testify on the bill? The audience is getting reduced. Let's close the public hearing and report session on House Bill 3354.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3354 to Senate floor.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 3354 to the floor to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? All right, so ordered. Okay, now that completes our agenda today. Senator Deckard, you missed those four bills. Would you like to vote on those bills?
That'd be great to vote.
Okay. I'm going to ask the rules be suspended so that Senator Deckard may vote on some of our previous bills. Is there any objection to that? All right, so we're, let me take that sheet back.
Can you do them all at once?
We do the work sessions on House Bill 2490. House Bill, well, depends how you vote, I guess. 2053, if you do it wrong, we got to go start all over again. House Bill 3360, House Bill 2219, to allow Senator Deckard to vote. How would you vote on 2490?
Aye.
2053?
Aye.
3360?
Aye.
2219?
Yes.
All right, Senator Deckard, record as an aye vote.
You have to carry a bill, too.
We close. Oh, and the last one. The last one. You heard the last one, so you can carry the electrical installation. Everybody's got a bill now. Okay, thank you, guys. We're adjourned.